Hello, everybody, and welcome to our first episode of the second season of In the Same Vein, a podcast out of the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester. I am Dr. Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Jan Gao.
And today we are talking to the wonderful Dr. Agnes Arnold Forster about her book, Cold Hard Steel.
Dr. Arnold Forster is a writer, researcher, and historian. She explores societies, cultures, medicine, science, technology, emotions, and the world of work. Her latest book is A History of Nostalgia, published by Picador in April of 2024.
But today we're actually talking about Dr. Arnold Forster's previous book, which is titled Cold Hard Steel, The Myth of the Modern Surgeon, published by Manchester University Press. In Cold Hard Steel, which Jan and I really enjoyed reading together, Agnes Arnold Forster sets out to anatomize the stereotype of the surgeon, offering a really exciting new history of modern and contemporary British surgeon. She draws on archival materials and original interviews with surgeons, analyzing them alongside a range of fictional depictions from the Doctor in the House novels to Mills and Boone romances and the soap opera Emergency Ward 10. So presenting a unique social, cultural, and emotional history, Dr. Agnes Arnold Forster shines a light on the development and perseverance of the myth of the modern surgeon and explains why it has proved to be so long-lasting. But at the same time, she explores the more candid and compassionate image of the surgeon that has begun to emerge in recent years, revealing how a series of high-profile memoirs both challenge the surgical stereotype and simultaneously confirm it. So we talk about all of those aspects of the book in this interview, and we also discuss how surgeons have reacted to this book, how learning about these stereotypes can help those in health professions or those who are training to be doctors or surgeons, and how learning about these cultural and historical myths and stereotypes can help those who don't seemingly fit into those stereotypes to break into the surgical field. It's a really interesting discussion that we have today that really shows how sustained and rigorous historical work can hopefully influence the practice of medicine and health policy. And we talk about that a lot, especially towards the end of the interview. And then Jan, do you want to say what led you to choose this book to talk about in our podcast episode today?
There were many incredible books that stood out to me while preparing for this episode with Dr. Slobogan, but I chose this one because it reflected my interests about the surgical identity. Back when I was a nursing student, I spent a lot of my clinical experiences working alongside and with surgeons while training for a future in OR nursing. I entered the OR with preconceived notions about surgery and surgeons, shaped largely by cultural and media representations. And I became interested in how the historical and contextual forces shape these myths of the modern surgeon and its origins. So I'm excited to have the opportunity to chat about this topic.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you picked this because obviously, you know, when you were in my class, we talked about the history of surgery a lot. So I'm glad that we get to continue to do this today. Okay. Hi, Agnes. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. It's so good to have you here. And if you don't mind, we'll go ahead and get started with the first question.
So first and foremost, we loved reading Cold Hard Steel. When someone says surgeon, we all have a particular image of what that surgeon looks like in our minds. But it was so helpful and interesting to have you tease out how that image may have been formed historically and culturally. What led you to investigating the myth of the modern surgeon?
I've always been interested in surgery, and my first book, my PhD was on the history of cancer, and surgery was in the 19th century and remains the frontline treatment for cancer. And so I was already doing a lot of work on surgeons, what it meant to be a surgeon, how surgeons came into being in the 19th century, kind of in the form that they are in now. And so it was obviously a subject that was already of interest to me, but then I got my first job after my PhD was a postdoc on a project called Surgery and Emotion. And as is so often the way in academia, the stuff you end up working on is a combination of pragmatism, the job market and interest. And so this was sort of sat at the sort of intersection of those three things.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you did end up working on this. Because yeah, like Jan said, we really enjoyed reading the book. So we would love to have you explain for our listeners, because obviously we read the book together, most of our listeners won't have. And a lot of the focus of Cold Hard Steel is on these surgical myths. So we would love to have you explain to our listeners just a few, maybe two or three of the main surgical myths or stereotypes that you identify in this book. And, you know, you talked about surgery and emotion, that project that you were on. And we're really interested in those myths associated with emotion, because that's not very often a word associated with surgery. So we'd love to hear more about that.
Well, absolutely. I think that's probably was my starting point, is the kind of myth that surgeons are emotionally detached or dispassionate, the idea that they don't allow feelings to interfere with their work, and that surgery is a particularly kind of, you know, even more so than other fields of medicine or care, that it is not something that involves or requires a huge emotional investment, or at least a kind of great deal of emotional expressiveness. There are other facets, and they kind of intersect with emotions in different ways. So I think one of the other kind of key features of the sort of surgical stereotype is to do with gender. So it's a very male-dominated profession. And I think the image that most people have when they think of surgery or think of surgeons is of a man. And it kind of is colored with a kind of machismo, a sort of forthrightness, a kind of almost bullish or very paternalistic, very authoritarian position, both with respect to their patient, so a kind of authority over their patient, but also authority over other members of the healthcare team, whether that's more junior doctors or nurses. So I think those are the kind of two kind of key features. There are other things. I mean, part of that is that like kind of authoritarianism, directiveness, quick decision making. And I think one of the kind of important things about these stereotypes is that they, by and large, with some exceptions, have shades of both kind of positive and negative within them. So it is, you know, if you are a quick decision maker, that is a good thing, right? You want someone who's operating on you to be fast at making decisions. But maybe at the other end of that spectrum, there's someone who is authoritarian, doesn't take input well from colleagues, you know, isn't interested in the desires or needs of their patients, perhaps. So all of these things have a kind of yin and yang to them. And I think that's one of the things that makes the stereotype so interesting, is that it is baked in within it are both good and bad, positive and negative.
Thank you for that response. That was extremely interesting. And I think we could see a lot of those yin and yang elements within the book, and especially with emotion. And even in the cover page, we were both really interested in why you chose this cover. We love it and how it connects to several elements and chapters of the book. But for our listeners, would you be able to draw out the connections and explain kind of the reasoning for this cover?
So the cover is, for those, you know, unlucky enough not to have seen it yet, is a kind of reworking of a 1960s Mills and Boone novel. And so Mills and Boone, so in the States, they're, you know, equivalent to Harlequin, and they publish kind of easy access romance novels. And from the sort of 60s onwards, they start publishing romance novels that have a doctor-nurse theme, which, as it sounds, mostly describe a relationship between a male doctor and a female nurse, although not exclusively. I use them a lot as a source in my book about kind of some of the articulation and kind of encapsulation, representation of some of these stereotypes and relationships. So that was one obvious reason why I wanted it to be on the cover. The other thing is I thought it was aesthetically very appealing, and I wanted people to buy my book or at least download it for free, which is also an option. And so I thought it would be eye-catching. And actually, when the publisher first came up with a different cover, and you know, this probably says really terrible things about me and my kind of intellectual rigor, but I was like really disappointed, and I just thought, I'm not that enthusiastic about this book anymore. I've judged my own book based on its cover. And so then when they came back with this reworked cover, the cover that it now is, I was like, oh, great. I've suddenly got all this new enthusiasm to work on it again. But yeah, if you're going to judge any book by its cover, please judge mine by this one.
I will also say, as I was choosing a project, I searched up a few of the books, and that one was the one that caught my eye. So I, in fact, also did judge your book by its cover.
I think that's a very normal and humane response, and no one should be ashamed of it. So
another question we had was, in the book, there is a large focus on identity and emotions of surgeons, as we discussed a little bit earlier. We were just wondering, how can those histories, what can they tell us about the field that more straightforward or traditional histories of surgical innovations, surgical biographies, and others cannot?
It's a great question. One of the things I will say about the book is that it is more a book about representations than realities, if that's a kind of fair, kind of crass generalization, and that I'm much more interested in how people identify themselves, represent themselves, or are represented by others, how that feeds into how people kind of feel about themselves, how they see themselves, and less about whether, you know, I'm not really in the market of discussing or debating whether surgery better dominate, well, I mean, it is unequivocally male dominated, but it's not really a book about like the dynamics at play that have made that happen, or a kind of quantitative analysis of, you know, men in the surgical profession or women in the surgical profession, although there's a little tiny sort of pieces of that here and there to kind of evidence, I suppose, my general claims. I'm interested in feelings, basically, as a historian, just generally, right? I'm interested in how do people feel about themselves? How do people feel about those that they work with? How do patients feel about their doctors? How do doctors feel about their patients? All those kinds of dynamics are the things that really motivate my own kind of really general, broad, like historical inquiry, my kind of sort of professional pursuits. And I think the kinds of more traditional histories that you talk about here, like technological innovation or professional development, I think that they can be expanded upon and illuminated by these more sort of, I suppose, cultural, emotional histories. There's lots of surgical biographies out there, you know, accounts of famous surgeons' lives and careers and, you know, what kind of great contributions they made. And I think the work that I do tries to see those biographies not just as historiography, but as sources. So how have those biographies not just kind of preserved and recounted the history of surgery, but in turn fed into our understandings of what it means to be a surgeon and how surgeons operate today? This is just a kind of small example, but surgery is an incredibly historically minded profession. So if you speak to surgeons today, a lot of them will be hobbying historians of their own professions, their own, you know, subspecialties, their own techniques, their own tools. But also they'll be very conscious of where they sit in a kind of lineage of surgery. So you often have surgeons referencing their relationship to their institutions, the institutions in which they trained, because so much of surgery is learnt via informal and formal apprenticeship. You know, there's a real sense of the kind of surgical family tree. And I think that my work tries to see the sort of mutually informative nature of that relationship, or kind of expose how that like historical identity, you know, still has bearing on how surgeons operate and conduct themselves and are perceived today.
I really like that you're emphasizing that you're focusing on feelings, because I think that word has different meanings to different people from emotion. Like, feelings are more everyday, and it's what we feel every day, whereas emotions is perhaps a grander word. History of emotions, you know, is a grander phrase.
And just on that point, I know that wasn't a question, but I think that's a really important and interesting distinction to make, because my book is, you know, in some ways a history of emotions, but it isn't a kind of technical history or sort of quasi-conceptual or cognitive history of emotions, right? It is about feelings, and it is very much about the everyday. And in fact, when I started this project, I thought it was going to be a project that was much more about not just the kind of more conceptual history of emotions, but more about the kind of high feelings of surgery, the kind of big, grand feelings of surgery and of all clinical practice. I thought it was going to be about grief, about patient loss, about, you know, the sort of stuff that people write in their own memoirs about being surgeons. But then I started doing interviews with surgeons, and almost immediately it became apparent that really all they wanted to talk about mostly was the sort of feelings of the everyday, the kind of tedium of surgery, like the frustrations of paperwork, of, you know, the boredom of meetings, the, you know, irritation of not getting the rota you wanted, those kinds of like sort of sort of stuff in between became really obviously part of like what actually people wanted to talk about and express. And so, you know, that was the thing that then started to really interest me, not so much the kind of tragic narratives of loss and pain and regret.
That's really great. Thank you so much. And that feeds perfectly into my next question, which is about those interviews and kind of your methods relating to them. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about how you went about recruiting for your interviews that, you know, kind of thread their way through this book. And then also because you do focus so much on, you know, telling the stories of folks who aren't the stereotypical white male, middle or upper class surgeon, I would love to hear how you went about finding interviewees and or archival information on surgeons who weren't or aren't part of that kind of stereotypical old gentleman's club.
So, I mean, if you were to ask me, technically, it's a kind of method of snowball recruitment. So I basically would meet people and then I'd ask them to recommend people that I should talk to. I spent a lot of time on social media. You know, this was the like heyday of Twitter. And so I did a lot of my recruitment on Twitter because historians like to spend a lot of time on Twitter, or did, but also so do physicians. And so there's a very vibrant network of healthcare professionals online that were easy to kind of tap into. I also met quite a lot of people as part of the Surgery and Emotion project that I was on. We ran a lot of events. And so I'd meet a lot of people, lots of surgeons at these events. And interestingly, and it's interesting that you note, you know, that a lot of these interviews are with people who don't accord to the stereotype. And I tried very hard to find, you know, women, female surgeons to speak to as well as men. But I think actually the consequence of that, or one of the consequences of that, is that it's quite imbalanced, that I didn't really get to speak to that many surgeons who really do fit the stereotype, of which there still are many. And so those surgeons kind of come through in these more like traditional conventional written sources, and a lot in fictional accounts as well. And, you know, you could say that this is a flaw in the sort of underpinning source material, which I would definitely concede. But it's also an effort to kind of, I suppose, correct or provide a corrective to the sort of existing stories that are the sort of predominant, prevalent narratives around surgery. And I think in general, this is a problem that's a kind of activist problem as well as a researcher problem in this sort of small niche area, in that part of the project's goals was to try and address this stereotype and to try and say, okay, there are other ways of being a surgeon, that emotions can have a place in surgical care and surgical identity. And we had a lot of really great responses to that, like a lot of people who come to our events would be really convinced by this and, you know, found it very compelling. But the problem is that the people perhaps we really needed to reach, the people that we really needed to say, to kind of convince, were not coming, and were not engaging, and were not participating in our events, and were not participating in my research. And so it's quite tricky, because there are definitely, and I see this, so I now work more in health policy. I see this all the time as a problem, that a lot of these sorts of really toxic narratives we have about healthcare professional well-being, they have a lot of really vocal challenge now, especially in kind of certain professional circles, like, for example, in Royal College of Surgeons of England, will kind of do good big statements or big projects on how important surgical well-being is. But there's still these sort of hardcore sort of resistors to those more progressive narratives. And they are very difficult to reach. They are very difficult to convince. And they are also often very powerful, at least in their own institutional settings, and have a lot of say over the careers and lives of their juniors, partly because of the way surgical training operates. It's still quite kind of apprenticeship based and still quite and very hierarchical. And so I think some of the problems, the methodological problems I had in my book, also bear witness to these sort of bigger methodological problems in the world of like healthcare reform, which is interesting.
Thank you for that response. One thing that we noticed throughout the book as well is that some of the contextual and social reflections in British society also reflected into the surgical community, and then whatever was happening in the surgical community reflected outwards.
Yeah, like a reciprocal influence. Yeah, between surgical culture made about surgery and the actual reality in surgery, kind of.
Yeah, they were kind
reinforced one another.
And I think when you touched on roles a little bit earlier, and with what we were just talking about, there was some pushback on changes that were being made within surgical communities. And as you write in your book, I think this goes more into roles. One person that you interviewed said, quote, plastic and ear and nose and throat ENT surgeons are supposed to be skilled at fine-tuned, detailed work that requires plenty of manual dexterity and are, as a result, attractive specialties to women with their supposedly more delicate fingers. Cardiothoracic surgeons and neurosurgeons are both thought to have God complexes and are populated by the most arrogant and self-assured practitioners. They are also some of the most hostile to female surgeons and are some of the least diverse, end quote. And that was on page 129 of the book. These are all such interesting points, and we've talked about how many of these subspecialty stereotypes trickle down to students as early as pre-medical undergrad. Could you talk a bit more about some of the different cultural stereotypes that you found for surgical subspecialties in your research and where you may have found this information and if any of your work in this area surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating kind of problem specific to surgery because it is made up of all these subspecialties that have these like very particular characteristics or identities. And, you know, a lot of this differentiation, I think, feels really harmless and very benign because so much of it is expressed in venues or in like circumstances of comedy or in kind of satire. So there's the problem is I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name or his pseudonym. There's he's a physician. I think he's an optometrist actually, but he has a very, very sort of huge social media following. He's called Dr. Glaucum Flecken. And he makes little kind of snapshot videos that he uploads to kind of TikTok and Twitter and I'm sure other places as well, where he kind of enacts little scenes where he plays the part of different medical and surgical subspecialties. And they're kind of very, they're pretty generous, right? They're like gentle ribbing. They're not like, you know, real takedowns of different subspecialties or anything. They're kind of pretty, inside jokes, I suppose, for the profession as at large. But they encapsulate exactly the kinds of things that are in that quote of like different sorts of characteristics that might embody certain subspecialties. And the reason I know that it's seen as by other healthcare professionals as like benign and funny and charming is because he has a huge following of healthcare professionals who think he's great and think he's really funny. No comment from me personally, but you know, he's very popular. He's a huge following. And so I think a lot of these sort of stereotypes and kind of caricatures are embedded through, you know, they're not expressed in particularly toxic sort of ways, but they can have these sorts of more like pernicious consequences. As you say, this is part of the kind of cultural soup in which people who are aspiring or training to be doctors exist in. And so what it does is it crafts a particular mold that aspiring doctors, pre-med students, think that they have to fit into or adhere to in order to be a cardiothoracic surgeon or an ENT surgeon or whatever. So even if they're not told at any point in their formal training, well, you have to embody these qualities if you're going to be a good neurosurgeon, they know from this kind of big cultural milieu, including these sorts of bits of comedy, that that's what's expected of them and that's how they should relate to their patients and to their colleagues. And so the risk is then that people who don't fit all of those characteristics or the most of them self-select out and think, oh, well, I'm not like that. I should do this other kind of medicine or other kind of surgery, or I should absent myself from the profession entirely. And then you risk not only kind of perpetuating those stereotypes and characteristics that they become true, but also you risk losing on a diverse talent pool, both diverse in terms of gender, race, class, but also diverse in terms of kind of personality type and working style and way that you interact with patients. And, you know, I think the thing that I've come away from the project with most is that diversity in both its kind of formal capital D sense and its sort of informal lower D sense is, you know, the thing that makes the profession or will make the profession better and better equipped at dealing the great diversity of patients.
That's such a great answer. Thank you. And feeds, again, perfectly into the next question, which is also about, you know, aspiring or trainee doctors and surgeons, but more generally rather than just the subspecialties. But I wanted to ask this question because, so I teach a class on surgical horror films to medical students. And we do that in order to explore some of the stereotypes and myths that our wider culture believes to be true about surgeons, or at least how they show up in culture, cultural products like movies. So I have my own answer to this question, but I wanted to hear from you. Why do you think it is so important to teach medical students, or more specifically, perhaps future surgeons, regardless of subspecialty, about the myths of the modern surgeon that we see in your book? And so what can healthcare in general gain from this type of education beyond the kind of diversity that you were just talking about in the answer to the last question?
I would say for me, there are lots of things. I think there are lots of really good reasons to teach medical students or aspiring doctors about the myths of modern surgery and indeed like the humanities and the history of medicine more generally. I think the kind of big sort of meta point I would make is that I think it makes for more humane and reflective professionals who are capable of seeing their work embedded within culture rather than separate to it. But more specifically, the stuff about kind of myths is that, and the why I think it's important not just to teach the kind of general kind of cultural narratives around surgeons, but also specifically to teach the history of these cultural narratives, is that it can identify or help students identify that these myths, these stereotypes had a starting point. They came from somewhere. They developed in response to very specific social, cultural, and political circumstances. They had a starting point, and so therefore they can have an end point. They are not enduring, eternal, essentialist characteristics, but things that are cultural products that have been made and therefore can be unmade. And I think that's very important for people who, particularly if they don't feel as though they fit some of these really more conventional traditional molds, or don't feel comfortable with some of these conventional traditional modes of interacting with or relating to patients and colleagues, because it says to them, okay, well, if this doesn't work for you, it can be dispensed with. And we know it can be dispensed with because surgeons of the past didn't do it like this. So I hope I got that answer right, Chrissy. Let me know.
My gosh, that was perfect. Thank you. Yeah, and that was, yeah, just basically adds on to the things that I was already thinking. And I think those are some really, really great points. So thank you.
Yeah, and to add on about how those stereotypes and histories have survived, one of our favorite points that you make in the book is how much history really does matter to surgeons. We wanted to ask, what have surgeons' reactions to this book been? Do they take issue with the points that you're drawing out from their history? They're not always flattering. Do they typically agree or disagree? We're just curious about that.
It's a very good question. I've had, you know, a mixed bag of responses. And both to the book, but also to kind of generally when I've expressed, especially when I've written along similar lines to what's in the book in more kind of surgeon-facing venues, like in magazines dedicated to surgeons or in medical journals and things like that. I generally get one of two responses. One is, this is great. This really chimes with some of my anxieties and apprehensions about the profession. This is the sort of kind of self-reflection we need to kind of move the profession onwards. Obviously, those are the responses that I like and I take note of and preserve. And then I also get more critical responses. And you know, of course, people don't have to like my work. That's fine. But a lot of that kind of critique comes from or is articulated in a way that I think reflects or demonstrates the importance of my work. So I'm putting this diplomatically. I get a lot of people who say things like, well, you know, we need to be like this. It is necessary that we are like this because, you know, either we need to work this hard, we need to conform to these hours, we need to dedicate this amount of service, we need to sacrifice our own lives because being a good surgeon requires this. And if you cannot do that, then you are not fit to be a surgeon. So you have fundamentally misunderstood, they're talking to me, you have fundamentally misunderstood the demands and requirements of the profession. which, you know, to a certain extent, I'm sure is true in that I am not a surgeon. I've never worked as a surgeon. And so I'm sure there is much of, you know, being a surgeon that I don't understand. There's an interesting kind of international dynamic here in that some of the critique I've got from US-based surgeons has been quite sort of specific to the US context. So in the UK, we have much more rigid limits on our working time, both generally, but specifically in medicine. And so surgeons in the UK cannot work 120-hour weeks, whereas in the US, they can and are often are expected to, especially at the beginning of their careers. And so some of the critique kind of doesn't, you know, reflects a kind of misapprehension of those differences. But I also think that there is still a sort of deeply held belief and conviction that surgery requires not just, you know, special devotion, dedication, self-sacrifice, but also special authoritarianism and hierarchy. And I think that a lot of surgeons today are very uncomfortable with or uncertain of moves towards sort of multidisciplinary teams, more sort of the sort of flattened hierarchies, more kind of democratic decision making within clinical practice, which, you know, is sort of the trend, I suppose, generally speaking, in healthcare. And I think a lot of surgeons feel hostile to that, to those trends. And I see my book as part of that movement, those trends, of which they are completely correct. That is, I would agree. And so, yeah, I think there's been, you know, a lot of positive feedback, a lot of kind of people feeling really good about what I've written about. And a lot of people who, you know, there's also a third category, which is the funniest one, which is professional surgeons who critique my historical credentials because they know more about surgery's history than I do, which I don't agree. But everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
Thank you for being so honest in those answers. I'm sure
surgeons are going to take issue with that characterization as well, but I'm standing by it. I wrote the book a few years ago now.
It's really useful to kind of hear what the feedback has been like. And of course, that's only the feedback of the folks who take the time to reach out to you.
Absolutely. I'm sure there are lots of people who read it and then instantly forgot it and have no opinions. Like, that's probably the most common response.
Or, you know, people who liked it, appreciated the work, but just aren't the kind of people to reach out to an author.
I honestly do, actually, any surgeon who reads it, I consider that to be a success, even if they hate it. You know, if it made them think and feel something, I feel like that's a good thing.
Absolutely. I wanted to add on to what you were saying, or ask another question in relation to what you were saying about kind of the international scope, especially, you know, we're based in the States, so I'm going to ask one of those kind of tricky comparative questions that historians often don't love getting, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So obviously, as you already alluded to, healthcare systems in the UK and the US are very, very different. So do you have any idea about how these differences in healthcare systems may have influenced the emotional and or cultural parameters of what it means to be a surgeon in the US versus what you talk about in the book in the UK?
Yeah. So I think there are lots of things I could say here. So I'll try not to grab it on too long. I think one thing I'd say is that the sort of starting point is that the healthcare system in the UK with our National Health Service is radically different to that of the US. I mean, that's an obvious point. I do think it's important, and I'll come back to why I think it's important in a second. But the first thing I'd say is that I also think that surgery is a international and internationalized profession, and that a lot of the kind of cultural trappings and kind of identity stuff that I write about are British exports, basically. You know, Britain very successfully and effectively, as part of its sort of general efforts at kind of imperialism, exported its own brand of medicine and surgery to the English and, to a certain extent, the non-English speaking world. And the US is one example of that. And that surgery has been self-consciously international in its development. There's a lot of formal and informal mechanisms that have been around for the last 150 years designed to kind of narrow the differences between surgeons working in Britain and in the US and in Canada and in Australia and in India. You know, there's a lot of transfer of professionals, lots of people who train in one place, work in another, and the shared sort of, you know, speaking English, I think, between Britain and the US and have a shared sort of intellectual kind of academic arena is also really important. So I think that's a kind of an important thing to note, that I think there are a lot of things that I describe about the British surgical stereotype that totally apply in the American context as well. And I think, you know, an American reading this book would recognize a lot there as well. In terms of like the sort of healthcare systems. I think that British surgeons and indeed British healthcare professionals have a slightly different role in British society because of the NHS. And because the NHS is a state-funded healthcare system, people who work for it are lauded in a slightly different way. It sort of softens in some ways some of the edges of healthcare professionals in Britain because they are seen as public servants, as kind of devoted to not just their patients, but also to the kind of national project. And because they cannot make decisions about the care they provide based on the income or financial freedom of their patients. So I think that does shape some of the kind of broader kind of macro cultural dynamics of healthcare professionals in general and surgeons specifically in Britain and in the US. British surgeons are paid a lot less than American surgeons. And so that, I think, also comes into the kind of social class aspect of it. Although, of course, relatively speaking, surgeons do make a lot of money in the UK by comparison to other members of the general workforce. And they also tend to come from very privileged social backgrounds in the UK and in the US. But I also think that there are different kind of cultural factors that aren't necessarily specific to medicine that make the US and the UK quite different. So I think some of the kind of work culture, the sort of ideas about work are quite different. A kind of very small example of this is that in Britain, pretty much all surgeons are unionized and are able to and have repeatedly participated in industrial action. I know that in the US that's on the rise and it's kind of a complicated story, but that I think is quite a different dynamic and means that surgeons relate differently to both their place of work and to work as a kind of factor in their identity. And generally, this sort of is a sort of trite sort of stereotype, but I think it kind of holds up. Americans work a lot harder than Brits. You know, we have longer holidays, we have more time off, we're paid less, but, you know, we do less work in exchange. And I think this is true in academia as well as in medicine. And I think those things do make a difference to kind of identity and ideas about devotion and vocation and machismo as well.
Thanks for that answer. As someone that grew up mainly in Canada, I think we're a little bit more like the British. You can definitely see the influence there. And just tacking on another question that goes along with class, hierarchy, other cultural aspects that are floating around our discussion today, you have a chapter on gender, a chapter on race and ethnicity, and class is obviously mentioned all throughout the book, and these all point to the fact that the quintessential surgeon is, quote, male, often white, and at the very least middle class, end quote, and that's found on the very first page of the book. How do you think that teasing out these elements of the history of the surgical stereotype can help those who don't fit that stereotype to kind of better understand and approach a career in surgery?
That's a really great question. What I hope it doesn't do is put people off. Like, I hope people don't read this and think, oh, well, this is not the place for me. This is not the profession for me. Although I think in some ways that'd be a very reasonable response. You know, no one is obliged to kind of take on the inequalities of the world through their choice of career. I think, again, you know, to go back to the response I gave about the importance of teaching the myth of the surgeon, I hope that people can see that these aspects of the surgical stereotype and indeed the surgical profession, you know, in reality, you know, it is, although, you know, it's increasingly diverse, it remains male dominated, it remains, you know, a profession that privileges white practitioners, and it remains overwhelmingly staffed by people from privileged social and financial backgrounds. I hope they can see that these things are, again, kind of cultural products about surgery, sort of embeddedness in society, and not kind of automatic or essentialist demands of the profession, that you don't need to be a man to be a good surgeon, but rather that the way surgery is set up prioritizes kind of conventional attributes or sort of perceived conventional attributes of masculinity, and also is very bad still at accommodating family life, caring responsibilities, those sorts of dynamics. I hope it can be a kind of galvanizing force that people feel better equipped and informed in order to engage in the kind of activism that's required to address these problems. I also would love for, you know, anyone who's either a surgeon or aspiring to be a surgeon who reads this to come away with a much more critical sort of perspective on the profession. I think that, you know, these aspects of the surgical stereotype, indeed the surgical stereotype more broadly, these are kind of complicated, nuanced sort of problems that have deep cultural and historical roots and are as much reinforced as they are undermined. And to untangle them and to unpack them is not going to be a straightforward process. So I want people to read the book to not only be critical of the profession, but also to be critical of perhaps more banal and simplistic attempts to address these problems. I was quite critical in the book of sort of campaigns to improve surgical resilience or improve surgical well-being, both things that I think are very important. But I think a lot of the strategies deployed have been really surface level, like providing yoga classes at lunchtime for surgeons to, you know, help them decompress. It's like, well, if you're not going to alter the structure of their working day, you're not going to have, you know, the kind of staffing requirements that are needed to give people that time off, if you're not going to, you know, compensate people fairly at different points of their career, you know, these sorts of interventions are, you know, useless and in fact only compound the problem. So I think in highlighting the complexity and sort of long-standing nature of a lot of these stereotypical features, I hope I can also kind of alert people to like the challenge ahead, not in a like demotivating way, but in a way that's like, you know, you should also be skeptical of the sort of, you know, simplistic stuff that some people in positions of, you know, healthcare management or sort of professional influence say and try and do.
Thanks for such a great answer. One of my favorite takeaways from the book was that kind of the ways that you debunk a lot of the myths and how there's actually a lot of nuance. There's truth in some there, and then there's also more, I don't know, some of them are less truthful, and there's a whole mixed bag within all of this, and it's not so black and white as people would think, even in the surgical identity. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. We're curious on what you are working on now and how do you hope to continue some of the work that you put out into the world with Cold Hard Steel.
Thank you. So in terms of research, I am now working on childbirth and maternity services in Britain in a kind of different way. I suppose in some ways it's got a lot in common, but I'm really interested in the concept of natural birth. This is an audio recording, so you will not have seen my like air quotes around natural, but know that they are there, and about how ideas about natural birth have infused NHS maternity services and how potential harms that those sort of concepts and ideas have done to birthing parents. And so that, you know, in some ways is about, again, the kind of cultures and identities of British medicine. So not massive departure. But as I sort of said very briefly, that I now am also working in health policy. And so I'm really interested in trying to kind of put some of the more sort of theoretical, historical findings and perspectives into practice and seeing if anything I learned in the process of writing that book can be turned into like practical interventions and policies.
That's really great. And, you know, I was just at the big history of medicine conference here, and the first plenary was all about historians in policy roles, especially in relation to everything that's going on here right now at the federal level. And it was really inspiring seeing all the work or all the good things that can happen when a historian is in the room doing healthcare policy. You know, mistakes get made every day, but some of those mistakes can be stopped or headed off when a historian is there to be like, wait, we've done this before, or let's think about the broader context here. So yeah, I really appreciate hearing that.
Very important that we infiltrate, I think. You know, we should be in all areas of business.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Agnes, thank you so much for joining us today. We really, really enjoyed talking to you and reading your book. And yeah, just thank you so much for your lovely answers and for writing this book.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.